Well, this afternoon I'm going to speak on a subject that has had a great deal of interest to me. I've studied this over a period of time, and this is kind of a compilation of material I've collected over quite a few years. And the question that has come up to me quite a few times is when I'm reading Bible commentaries or I'm studying a specific subject. And the question comes up is, why is there such a great gulf? Why is there this great difference between what we read in the Bible and what God explains to us and what many of these experts and scientists and these Bible commentaries and Bible scholars have a completely different take on many of these subjects that we study. Why is there this great gulf between the two? Because pretty much across the board, 9 times out of 10, if you ask any modern Bible scholar or scientist about creation or pretty much any event that's described in the Bible, you know, you pick it from Genesis to Revelation, they're going to pretty much tell you that it didn't happen that way or it didn't happen at all. And so this poses a big problem for a lot of people who maybe they are professional, they have gone to higher education, they have a degree, they look to many of the science schools of thought for answers, but at the same time they look to the Bible for answers as well, and it poses a problem. It poses a big problem for some. And so the question is how did this come to be? How did it come to the place and be where there's this big gap between what we read in the Bible and from what many of the experts in science claim to say as well? A lot of this started with the Industrial Revolution. Help me out here, Tom. There we go. A lot of this started with the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. And really, the Industrial Revolution did just that. It revolutionized the world. Beginning with the mass production of steel and the steam locomotive, the telegraph, and many of these other inventions that were made, the real advancement wasn't in the inventions themselves, but how it changed people's thoughts, how they could think for themselves, make deductive reasonings, and better humanity and mankind. And so soon there were great leaps in medical science. You know, many of the diseases that had previously plagued the world were really eradicated in just a short number of years. Great advancements in manufacturing not only raised the standard of living to many, but it also made worldwide travel available to millions. And all of these discoveries really took place during a very short period of time that laid the groundwork for the technology boom that we have today. And as they have many of these different schools of science, those who were involved in science gained a lot of respect. But not only that, those who were involved in some of the less acknowledged schools of thought were also given a lot of credibility as well. And here's some good examples here. We see many of these fathers of these different schools of thoughts. And one thing that all these men have in common is the fact that they were really the founders of all these different schools of thought. But at the same time, they were created during the 19th century when all of this information explosion took place. And many of the ideologies these men have really weren't given the time of day prior to. But after the Industrial Revolution, when science really gained a lot of credibility, so did these other sciences, such as, you know, evolution, psychology, eugenics, you know, anthropology, communism, sociology. Some of these had their place, some of them did, but a lot of them sprang up through this rise in intellectualism. And by intellectualism, I mean that research was done. Conclusions were drawn in a scientific manner, and because they were done in this manner, they're almost instantly deemed as being credible, even if it replaced other, you know, tried and proved methods, maybe tried and proved methods that were proven over thousands of years. The dictionary defines intellectualism as placing the excessive value on the intellect, or the doctrine that reason is the ultimate criteria for knowledge. Well, you're thinking to yourself, well, what's wrong with intellect and reason? You know, how can we make decisions without intellect and reason? Well, the problem is that quite often during this period of time, when these studies were done, conclusions were drawn, because they were done in a supposedly scientific manner, nobody really questioned their conclusions. Even if it had replaced, common sense, common sense that had been built up over hundreds and thousands of years. Nobody really checked their math. A lot of the sciences were done in a very credible manner, and they really advanced mankind, but some of these other sciences really weren't as credible, but they were given an opportunity because of this increase in scientific discovery. And nobody really checked their math. You know, for instance, when our children are doing their homework, they're supposed to work the problem out on paper and then show their answer at the bottom. And then they check their answer to make sure it makes sense. For instance, one banana plus one banana equals 20 bananas. Well, there's a problem here. You know, you check your math, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter how much of an inner monkey you might have. It doesn't matter how much you like bananas. One banana plus one banana is two bananas, not 20. And quite often we see this kind of stuff happen quite often in the name of science. I don't know if I've mentioned it here or not before, but I've talked about how Margaret Mead, through her anthropological work — this anthropology was another science that was founded and created in the 19th century — she came to the conclusion through studying the Samoan people that marriage is outdated. See, the Samoan people supposedly had all these open marriages, and they shifted partners back and forth, and everybody had accepted it, so there was no real problems associated with it, like domestic violence, divorces, breakups, illegitimate children. The problems weren't there because everybody accepted it. It was okay. And, well, the scientific community never really criticized the work, and they thought this was great. They embraced it with open arms. Despite the fact that she didn't speak the language, she was only there for a couple of months. She only interviewed people from a select age group, from 18 to 24. And not only that, she was having an affair during the very time she was conducting her research. But because she did it in a scientific manner and proposed her information in a scientific manner, everybody ate it up and thought it was great. Well, no one bothered to check her math, because today, the prisons are full of the product of broken marriages, open relationships, and illegitimate children. You know, there's a super majority, an unproportionate amount of fatherless children in the prison systems today, the product of infidelity. So it doesn't really matter to these intellectuals. It matters is how the research was supposedly done. Nobody does a reality check on many of these things. A lot of it's based on the credibility of the scientists. And with this, intellectualism also spread to many other areas, including theology. It was during this period of time that it became fashionable for many of these Bible scholars to take a critical view of the Bible, to take this minimalistic view of the Bible and say many of these events didn't take place. The Bible is not a historical authority, and really has no value on a scientific level. You know, they said the Hittites didn't exist. Well, they found, later on thousands of these clay tablets from the Hittite Empire. But for, quite a good period of time, they said the Hittites didn't exist. They said the Amorites didn't exist. Well, they found evidence of the Amorites. They said the Assyrians didn't exist, and the city of Nineveh, we can find it. It doesn't exist. It's a huge city that's described by Jonah. You know, it's all a bunch of fables. Well, they found the city, and it was as big as the Bible said, and it's got some huge gates out in front of it that they were able to dig up. They also said that, there's no evidence of King David existing. Well, quite a bit later, they found the Tel Dan stele that describes, the dynasty of King David as well. And so a lot of these, over a period of time, some of these evidences come up, but it never gets really publicized at all, and they continue down this path of wanting to disprove the Bible. The Dead Sea Scrolls was a big blow. The finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls was a big blow because it really confirmed the accuracy of the Bible as well. Well, this afternoon I'd like to examine some of these higher level critical views of the Bible and examine some of their arguments. Because eventually we will be confronted by someone, whether we're reading in Bible commentaries or we're studying information on the internet or we run across somebody at work who might be an atheist trying to disprove the Bible. We are going to be confronted with these arguments eventually. And we don't need to be caught off guard thinking that somehow the foundation of our belief has been eroded away by some of these clever arguments that these minimalists like to take while they're attacking the Bible. Now, as we examine these arguments, I want you to really take a look at the pattern that these individuals use when they're making these attacks on the Bible. One of the first ones that we're going to see that happens quite often is while although they take a they're very methodical on the way they gather their data, they're very methodical on how they log and keep track of their data. But when it comes time to make conclusions based on that data, that's when it seems like all reason gets thrown out the window. A good example of this is when I was listening to an online Yale University class discussing the account of the biblical flood. And the professor, she stated that almost all civilizations in the area of Middle East have some version of the Noachian flood account. And it's very similar to the biblical flood account. Well, you're thinking, well, this is great, because not only have they found accounts of the biblical flood in the Middle Eastern area, but on this map, we're going to see that there was areas all over the planet where they've found, these stars represent civilizations where they have stories of the biblical flood account, where they have a story of some guy in a boat who saved the world, or was saved through this flood event that was caused by God. He saved himself and the family and animals as well. And so these five different points are in about 35 different stories around the globe describing this flood account. Well, you're thinking, well, this is great. When you have all these civilizations describing the same event, well, that increases the odds that maybe it actually did happen, you know. More witness to the event means that it's been substantiated. Well, that's not what she said. What she said is, this simply means that Moses plagiarized his story from all the civilizations around him. You know, God didn't receive the story about the flood from divine revelation. He was just copying the story that was floating around all over the place. And Moses or whoever wrote the book of Genesis simply copied it from oral traditions that he saw floating around. And so here's a prime example where you have the same data, the same information, but totally entirely different conclusions are drawn. And what's also interesting, when she was giving her class, the other argument is never brought up. She says, well, some feel this way about this data and some feel this way. That's never brought up. All that's brought up is dogmatically stating that Moses plagiarized this story from all the other civilizations around him. And so that's a pattern that we see quite often that they use is when it comes time to draw their conclusions on their data, that's when logic and reason gets thrown out the window. Another pattern that we see quite often amongst Bible scholars is when they do publish their conclusions, once again, they will show quite predominantly all the arguments that support their beliefs, but they never show any of the other arguments. And, you know, they don't present it as, well, according to the data we found, there was good cause to believe this, but there's also a counter-argument over here, and there's data that kind of supports that, but we believe this over here. They don't do that. They kind of hide or push to the back corners all this other data, and then they amplify and project the data that they like. A good example of this is when we look at the Exodus count from Egypt. You know, they will say quite dogmatically that there is no Egyptian records whatsoever that, or archaeological evidence whatsoever that supports the Exodus account in Egypt. Well, you're thinking, well, this sounds pretty bad for the Bible because there were some pretty serious events that took place during the time of Exodus. Here you've got a couple million foreigners living in the Delta area of Goshen. You've got a foreign ruler, you know, Joseph, who lived over the land of Egypt for, who ruled over the land of Egypt for a while. You've got, the death of the firstborn. That must have caused a little bit of stir. And you've got all the plagues that took place. You would think with all this taking place, there would be some evidence some of this took place. Well, they're going to say, well, there's no evidence whatsoever. But what they aren't telling you is there is a lot of evidence that supports all that, but they date it at a different period in time, and so they won't attribute it to the Exodus. They have found, you know, a lot of settlements by foreigners in the Delta area, and the reason they know they're foreigners is the Egyptians hated livestock and they kept them far away from the towns. Well, these foreigners had an area behind their houses, had a barn built into their house where they kept their livestock safe. And so they could tell, well, these were foreigners, and they had other clues that these were foreigners. They also found some mass graves around the, you know, 14th century BC, the time when the Bible attributes the Exodus took place. They found mass graves. And, you know, the Egyptians are very methodical in how they embalm people and how they have their whole ceremony with the funerals. Well, they didn't have time for that during the Exodus death of the firstborn. They just threw everybody in a pit, and they found these mass graves in Egypt. And this is something that's very uncommon for, you know, the Egyptians. Another thing that they found that was quite interesting is they found a statue of a foreign ruler in the Delta area. And if you look on it right here, he's got a coat of many colors, and he also has a staff in his left hand there, and that is a symbol of a foreigner. And so here you got this foreign ruler wearing a coat of many colors, and they have this monument made to him in the Delta area of Egypt. But they're not going to tell you any of this information because it's dated at a different time, or they date it at a different time. And so here's another example where they have all this evidence, but they don't publicize it because it was written at a different time, and so it's all irrelevant. And so that's another common practice that we see with many of these people who are critical of the Bible. Another problem that we see quite often with many of these Bible scholars and minimalists of the Bible is that there's quite often a considerable amount of peer pressure to try and disprove the Bible. Many of these intellectuals amongst themselves think that, I don't know, they're smarter than God or whatever the reason, but it's like there's an overwhelming movement to want to try and disprove the Bible. And a good example of this is through the excavation of Jericho in 1907. There were two German archaeologists, Ernest Snelling and Carl Watzinger, that did the initial excavation of Jericho. And they came to the conclusion that the city was unoccupied during the 14th century B.C., the time when the Bible attributes Joshua came in and destroyed the city. But these men, they did their research, they made their digs, and they said, no, the city was completely, unoccupied at the time, so there's no way that Joshua could have came in and destroyed them like it says. Well, shortly thereafterwards, in 1930, so we're talking about 23 years later, John Garstang, a British archaeologist, he conducted his own dig. And he went in there and studied, he dug in there until 1936, and he came up with completely different conclusions. He said not only does this fit the time period of the 14th century BC when the Bible says it was destroyed, but a lot of the artifacts he pulled out seems to support the biblical record. Well, his findings really disturbed a lot of the archaeological community, and when he published them. And shortly thereafter, funding came out of nowhere within like a couple of years for Kathleen Canyon to go back into Jericho and perform her own dig. And what do you know? She supported what the other two gentlemen had originally discovered, that the city was unoccupied, that there's no correlation between that and what the Bible record has said, and it kind of stood that way for about 50 years. For about 50 years, Kathleen Canyon was the last authority on the destruction of Jericho. Well, in 1990, a number of biblical scholars went in there and they re-examined Kathleen Canyon's data. And once again, they didn't do a new dig. They just reevaluated her, the artifacts she pulled up and a lot of her records that they pulled up. And they found out the exact opposite. That not only did was the city occupied during this period of time, that was the period of time it was destroyed, but not only that, there appeared to be a large earthquake that destroyed the walls of Jericho. They actually had fallen down outwards. You can see here, here's the base of the city wall there in Jericho, and it fell right over in front of it. I mean, it was sheared off right at ground level. And they attribute that to an earthquake that simply knocked it down outwards. And in the process, here's a depiction of the walls falling down. As they began to fall down, it created a nice ramp for the people to run up and charge the city, just like it mentioned in the biblical account. And not only that, in the biblical account, it mentions that they weren't supposed to take any of the food or any of the livestock. They were supposed to burn the city with fire, and then afterwards they could come in and take the gold or silver, but they weren't supposed to take any of the food, and that's exactly what they found. They found all these clay pots full of burnt seeds and grain that were all stored up, which fits the biblical account. Normally when a city is attacked, they take everything. And so this was very uncommon for the city to be destroyed and everything was left behind for the taking. And not only that, another little find that they found out was right in the corner of the walls, where you can see right here where the walls met, like up in that corner, was kind of the bad part of town. That's where some of the less predominant people of society hung out, like the harlots and whatnot. This is the red light district. And when the walls fell outward, they fell out like this, and it kind of protected that one little area in the corner remained behind. And they said that could have been very well where Rahab the harlot's residence was at the time. And so, as they look through many of these findings, it seems like there's this predominant view for many of these biblical scholars to try and disprove the Bible. And today, if you look at many of the accounts they have, they still don't like to admit evidence like this. And so it seems like time and time again, there seems like this persistent and continuous attack by many of these minimalists and the intellectual community to try and disprove the Bible, even when there's considerable flaws that they're presented with. It's very reluctant or not even impossible for get them to admit or change their position. Now, one of these attacks of the Bible was, and a very well-known one, was made by Julius Wellhausen in 1895. And he, to this day, has been pretty much a standard view of many of the Bible scholars, and he proposed the documentary hypothesis of the Old Testament. And he basically states that the first five books of the Bible weren't written by Moses. Matter of fact, they weren't even written in the 15th century BC. They were actually written almost 1,000 years later. And so not only can you not attribute this to a single author, he says there was multiple authors, but we don't even know if Moses even existed. Pretty much the first five books, the Pentateuch, is just kind of a patchwork of different writers that contributed to this big mass, and it was sold to the public around the time of King Josiah. Well, what Wellhausen did to come to this conclusion was he studied the literary style of the first five books, and he determined that there's different vocabularies that are used, there's different writing styles, there's different titles that are being used for God, there's different place names used throughout this period of time. And so that's where he came to the conclusion that there must have been a conglomeration of different contributors to this to the first five books, to the Torah, and there's no way this could be attributed to a single author. And of course, this theory was, you know, widely accepted by most of the intellectual community, and pretty much still is to this day. And one of the reasons why the documentary hypothesis is such a big victory for many of these skeptics is because of how big of a blow it is to the Bible. Because as we know, pretty much everywhere from Genesis to Revelation, Moses is attributed as the author of the first five books. You know, here we got the 1 Kings verse 2, verse 3. King David attributes the law of Moses, the first five books to Moses. 2 Kings 14, verse 6, you know, Hezekiah attributes it to Moses. 2 Kings 23, verse 25, Josiah attributes it to Moses. 1 Chronicles 15, verse 15, Ezra and Nehemiah attribute these first five books to Moses. Of course, we got Daniel and Malachi as well. And all throughout the Gospels, they all attribute these first five books to the law of Moses. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 24 and verse 44. And here's a classic reason why, if they can unravel who the author of the first five books are, you know, it's a big victory for them. Luke chapter 24 and verse 44. And he said to them, he being Christ, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me." And then he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the Scriptures. And so Christ here, he's attributing the Holy Scriptures to this three-part division of the Old Testament, the Law of Moses, the Prophets, and the Psalms. And he's saying that the first five books were written by Moses. And so if you've got everywhere from Genesis to Revelation, the whole Bible is attributing the Torah to Moses, if you can prove that it wasn't actually written by Moses, well, there's some kind of major fraud going on. You know, the reader's being lied to, there's this big scam taking place, and all those who have contributed to this fraud, including Christ himself, you know, they can be considered as a fraud as well. You can pretty much throw the whole book out the window. And so once again, we're going to see some of these common mistakes that are made in this type of a theory. We're going to see that the information that Wellhausen had is accurate. We're going to see the analysis of this data that he made, it was accurate as well, but when it comes time to draw these conclusions, he's way out to left field. First of all, the Bible doesn't say that every single word of the first five books of the Bible were designed, chosen, and handcrafted by Moses himself. He had no outside help. He kind of went into his cave and put in earplugs and wrote it all by himself. He's not going to take any input from anybody else. He just got down and started writing. And that's not what the Bible says at all. First of all, there's a considerable amount of the Pentateuch that was authored by God himself. Over in Exodus chapter 24 in verse 4, and overall also over in Exodus 34 verse 4, it says Moses wrote down all the words which the Lord had spoken. And so, first of all, we're going to see God was a big contributor to the Old Testament. And so he's going to have a different writing style. He's going to choose words in a different manner. He's going to have different titles that he uses for himself and for others. And he's going to have a different perspective on things. And so there's one contributor to the Torah. Another one we can see is over in Genesis chapter 14 and verse 14. We're going to see that there were some editorial updates that took place. In the Pentateuch, but also in some of the other books, but primarily a lot of it was done in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 14 and verse 14. "Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, He armed his 318 trained servants who had been born out of his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Well, you're thinking to yourself, Dan wasn't even born yet. Not only that, if Moses wrote this, the promised land hadn't even been divided up. Dan hadn't even been given a territory, let alone a city that he could occupy. So how could have Abraham chased these men all the way to, as far as Dan? Well, this is one of the editorial updates that was done by Ezra and Nehemiah. See, Ezra and Nehemiah completed the canon of the Old Testament. And when they did, they compiled all the different, minor prophets and brought them all together in one book. They also updated some of these, place names. There were some names that were used for places that no one knew where they were at and the reader didn't understand, and they updated some of these names. They also changed the script. Previously they used this Paleo-Hebraic script. Looks a lot like, chicken feet. It's a really, every now and then you'll see a few carvings that they found that still have the old Paleo-Hebraic. But the Samaritans had their own copy of the Bible floating around that they had changed a bunch that they liked a lot better. And so the Ezra and Nehemiah rewrote the Old Testament in the Aramaic script, is what we see nowadays when we see Hebrew. That's the Aramaic script that they had learned when they were in Babylon. And he did it to show there'd be a distinct difference between the Samaritan's Bible and the Hebrew's Bible. But the bottom line is here is the Ezra and Nehemiah, they made some editorial updates to the Bible at this time. They were both prophets, and so they had the ability to do that. Another addition that was made, we can read over here in Deuteronomy, chapter 34 and verse 10. This is another addition that was made by Ezra and Nehemiah. So since then, there has not arisen a prophet, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. Now, you wouldn't make this statement, 15 minutes after Moses died. This was not written between Deuteronomy 34 and Joshua 1, verse 1. This was written a considerable time. You wouldn't say, yeah, there hasn't been a guy like Moses in the last 15 minutes. I don't know when this prophecy is going to come true, but I'm still waiting for the guy. You know, Ezra and Nehemiah are making the point here that this prophet, like unto Moses, has not come on the scene yet, and we're still waiting for something. And they wrote this at the conclusion of the canonization of the Old Testament. And this, as we know, is definitely pointing towards the Messiah, but that's the point that Ezra and Nehemiah were making to the readers, is we're still waiting for this prophet like unto Moses. Well, you're not going to make this statement 15 minutes after after Moses has died, and we also have the rest of the verse, chapter 34, it talks about them mourning for Moses for 30 days. And so obviously there were some additions that were made in here, and they weren't made by Moses himself. And so once again, you're going to have some different changes made. There's some editorial updates, but there's no fraud taking place here. This isn't like someone's trying to slip something in afterwards. The Jews are very aware of this, and they have made this stuff clear. It's been publicized before. But there's no fraud taking place to the reader. Another example of additions that were made to the Torah is over in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 14. And there are some Bible scholars that will admit this one. I've actually read it in several commentaries. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 14. And this talks about how a king is supposed to govern himself, how he's supposed to act. And he says, when you come into the land which your Lord is giving you, and you possess it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations round about me, you shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses from amongst your brethren. You shall not set a foreigner over you. And he gives all these rules and duties of the king. He's supposed to write for himself a book of law. He's supposed to multiply for himself horses. And all these instructions are given. Well, why would the people, why would Samuel say, why have the people rejected me? You know, they've not rejected you. God said they've rejected me. Why would this rejection take place if it was already written here in the book of Deuteronomy that they could have a king if they come into the land and they possess it, just like what took place? This is exactly what took place. They went into the land, possessed it, and they said, well, I want a king over me like all the other nations. Why was this a big deal if the instructions were already given? Well, let's turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 10. 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 25. And Samuel told them, he told the people, the manner of the kingdom and wrote it to them in a book. And my Revised Standard Version says, Samuel told the people the rights and the duties of the king and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his own house. Well, I don't know of any place in the Bible where it talks about the rights and the duties of a king other than Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14. That's the only place it's described. And so when the people demanded a king, God obviously told them to give them what they wanted, and he wrote the rights and the duties of the king, and he inserted it back here in Deuteronomy chapter 17. And many of the commentators acknowledge that this was at the end of the scroll. They have the Bible laid out in scrolls, and Deuteronomy 17 verse 14 is at the end of the scroll. So Samuel obviously must have gone back. He inserted it in at the end of the scroll where he had room, and it became part of the first five books of the Bible. And once again, he's going to have a different writing style. It's going to be a little different. But the bottom line is there's no fraud taking place here. This isn't like somebody's trying to pull the wool over somebody, and this is some fast move that's being taken place. Another contributor we're going to see here to the Old Testament is described over in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 4. Let's turn there. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 4. And as we read through the first chapter, it describes the creation. And this is one of the arguments that Julius Wellhausen gives. It describes the creation account. It describes the 7 days of creation. And then when we come over to chapter 2, it starts talking about the creation again. It talks about forming man out of the dust of the ground. And so they're saying, well, this is why we've got different authors here. Well, Moses says there's different authors here. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 4, it says, and this is what my New King James says, this is the history of the heavens and earth when they were created in the day that Lord God had made the heavens and the earth. And some translations say this is the history, or this is the book of the heavens and the earth when they were created. And so this was a source document that Moses had access to, and he was the editor-in-chief. He compiled all this information. He brought it together. But once again, Moses was involved in this. It can be attributed to him, but he was collecting all this information that he obviously had access to, maybe given to him by Jethro or given to him by as a prince of Egypt. We don't know, but he had this information, and he included it. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1. Here's another example. He says, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. And some say book, some translations say history, and the day that God created man. Genesis, we don't have to turn there, but Genesis chapter 10, it says, this is the book or the genealogy of the sons of Noah. Genesis chapter 25 says, this is the genealogy or the book of Ishmael. Genesis 36, this is the genealogy or book of Esau. And so the bottom line is he brings in these different source documents. I'm sure he did some editing. I'm sure God was there with him when he was bringing this in and when he spoke to him in the tent. But there's no fraud going on here. When different Bible figures, including Christ himself, attributes the first five books of the Bible to Moses, they aren't saying every single word was chosen, authored, designed, and handpicked by Moses himself. Nobody's saying that. And the Jews even admit this in their own writings. But this is another example where the Julius Wellhausen and these other minimalists, they do a great job of analyzing the data. They do a great job of collecting the data. But when it comes time to draw a conclusion based on it, then all logic goes out the window. Another criticism of the Bible that has been widely acknowledged and accepted by a large number of scholars is that not only was the first five books of the Bible not written by Moses himself, but it wasn't written until the 9th or 10th century B.C., around the time of King Josiah. And so much of the accounts we read about the patriarchs, about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they have no real historical accuracy. You're not going to be able to come back, 1,000 years ago and guess how these different people lived. If that's when the creation took place, that would be when, on the timeline that Abraham and the patriarchs existed. Well, they said it actually wasn't written over here until almost 1,000 years later, around the time of King Josiah. And so their point they're making is there's no historical value to these to the book of Genesis and to this information. The writer simply assumed that Abraham had the same customs and beliefs as the nation of Israel, but there's really no historical value. Here's a quote by Gretton von Hausen. He says this: "We cannot gain any historical knowledge of the patriarchs, but only about the time in which the narratives were written in Israel. The period, with all of its deep and superficial characteristics, have been unconsciously projected back, where it is reflected as a transfigured ghost." So basically, we don't really know anything about these figures, only how the writer, how he projected his customs and values onto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But about them specifically, we don't really know a whole lot. And that's the argument that they've said. And of course, this idea has been well accepted by many of the Bible scholars. Depending on the commentary that you buy or purchase, a lot of this is going to be in it when you're reading it. You have to take that into consideration. And many of these Bible scholars and higher level thinkers, they not only questioned, how these people lived, but whether they even existed at all. And many of them will refer to them as, heroes of folklore or legendary figures, as if this is just a story. We don't even know if these guys even existed. And to this day, most Bible scholars try to hold to this belief to one way or the other. Matter of fact, if you look up the subject of Abraham in Wikipedia, they're going to speak pretty dogmatically about the fact that there is virtually no historical value whatsoever about the stories of Abraham. And it was actually written quite a bit of a time later. Well, however, since the 19th century, when a lot of these views were built, now here in the 20th century, a lot of archaeological evidence has been found actually showing the opposite. That actually proves a lot of the historical value of the information given in the book of Genesis about the patriarchs and about how they lived, and it shows that it was actually written during the 20th century B.C., not in any other later time period. Here's a quote by Kenneth Kitchen. He says this: "Time and time again, the Old Testament studies were told that history knows of no such person as Abraham or Moses, or knows of no such battle of that of Genesis 14. However, such phrases are totally misleading. They simply cover up the ignorance of the person, not of history, only of the person making the claim." Here's another quote by John Bright. He says this in The History of Israel. He says, "When the traditions are examined in light of the archaeological evidence, The first assertion is to be made that the stories of the patriarchs fit unquestionably and authentically in the middle of the 2nd century BC and not in any other later period. And I'm going to just kind of highlight some of this evidence they picked up that actually shows the validity of many of these of the stories that we read about the patriarchs in the book of Genesis. One of these is found over in Genesis chapter 16. Let's turn there. And we all know the story about Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. You know, Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham and told her, I want some children by Hagar. And there's some very interesting points in here if we take a close look at it. Genesis chapter 16 and verse 2. So Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I can shall obtain children by her. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarai. So notice that what she's saying here is, he's not saying, okay, Abraham, I can't have children. Why don't you go marry Hagar here and you can have a son, you can have an heir through him, through her. That's not what she said. She said, perhaps I can obtain children by Hagar. Not that you can have a son by Hagar, I can have a child by Hagar. Well, why does she say it that way? Well, it's actually said this way in another spot. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel. And he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb? So she said, here is my maid Bila. Go into her and she will bear a child on my knees, that I also may have children by her. So once again, it's Rachel that's receiving the children. It's not Jacob. And notice where she says, I will bear a child on my knees. Well, there was a custom in the area of the Chaldeans, which is where all the custom, that's where Abraham came out. He came out of Ur of the Chaldeans. And they kind of set the standard for a lot of the culture in that area. And it was very customary, and it was a lot in a lot of the marriage contracts, that if the wife was not able to bear an heir for the husband, that it was her duty to go out and find a surrogate mother so that she could have an heir. And this was a surrogate. It wasn't as much like having a second wife. It was, but it wasn't. Because in a lot of these marriage contracts, the child that was born became the legal son or daughter of the barren woman. And so that's why it says, I may also have children by her. And they found these clay figurines, these depictions, that pictured three people. They showed the maid that delivers the child. Somebody help me out here. Midwife, yes. They showed the midwife delivering the baby, then they showed the pregnant woman giving birth, and then they showed a third woman standing behind her on her knees. And so that was customary for the surrogate mother to stand, to have the barren woman stand behind the surrogate as they were delivering birth, obviously to help her as well, but that was the legal procedure that they went through, and that's why it says on there that I may have children by her and I bear a child on my knees. And this was one of the traditions they had during the 20th century BC and not in any other later time period. This was not a custom of the Israelites. This was not a custom of the nations of Canaan. This was a custom that only was around during the 2nd century BC and later faded away. And so this is one of the good examples of the historical value of the stories of the patriarchs. Another example is over here in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 2. Just turn there. But Abraham said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing that I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus? Now, why did Abraham say that his heir was Eleazar of Damascus? I don't know if you remember, but it was Eleazar of Damascus that went and got the wife for Isaac. He went out and acquired the wife for Isaac. And Eleazar of Damascus was a slave born in his house of Abraham. Well, why would his slave be the heir of all of his wealth? Well, once again, this was a custom of this period of time that a slave that lived in your house, even though he was a slave, if he was born in your house, he was a closer heir to you than a next of kin like Lot. You would have thought, well, Lot should have been the heir of all of Abraham's wealth. You know, he lived just down the road, and there's different stories where they're talking together. But once again, he wasn't part of that household. And until Abraham had a son, the heir of his wealth was Eleazar of Damascus. And once again, this was a much different system of inheritance than the Israelites had in the land of when they had moved into the land of Canaan. You know, in the laws and customs we see in the book of Exodus, property rights were very important, and keeping that property within the family was very important. That's where everybody had a way of bringing up a livelihood. Worse comes to worse. You can always, if your last name Sanchez, you can always go back to the family farm. And that's the way God had it set up, to have always have land rights so everyone had a place to go. And so because of that, the inheritance always stayed within the family. Well, that wasn't the case in the customs of the Chaldeans. And so this is a good example where they had a much different set of customs in the 20th century than they did in the time in the land of Egypt, or in the land of Israel. Another good example of how the Bible is historically accurate is with their pricing. Throughout the book of Genesis, they give pricing for different things that were purchased and bought and sold. They've uncovered some information on the Hittites, and when Abraham bought the field from the sons of Heth, and it describes how much he paid for it, that fit with the price of the time and day. Not only that, there's a few more examples they give when they slaves were bought and sold. And I don't know if how many of you realize how important pricing is and how much it can change over a period of time. And we know things in our day-to-day prices change. And if you're trying to guess what pricing was 100 years ago, 200, 1,000 years ago, you're not even going to come close. A friend of mine in college, he was telling me about how he had records of his family assets they had when they had moved into Missouri during the early 1800s. And his ancestor had purchased some good bottom ground, some good cotton-growing ground that he purchased for $3.50 an acre is what he paid for it. Well, then he had some upper kind of undeveloped kind of brushy area in the hills. He paid $1 an acre for that. But at the same time, he paid $100 for his two mules. And so that's how the pricing was. Land was cheap then, but animals weren't. Well, right now in Valley Springs, I can go down the street and buy a donkey for $100. And so pricing for donkeys hasn't changed at all in the last couple hundred years, but I sincerely doubt you're going to be able to find any land in Missouri for $1 an acre. And so that's the kind of trouble you can get into if you're going to try and guess, which is what they try and say, that the book of Genesis was written 1,000 years after these events took place, if you're going to try and guess what the pricing are. But time after time, it comes in exactly of what they have dug up in their archaeological findings. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 28. says, the Midianite traders passed by, and so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph into Egypt. So at that point in time, the going rate for a slave was 20 shekels of silver. Well, you don't have to turn there, but if you flip over a bit, you can go to Exodus 21, verse 32, and it says that the going rate for a slave was 30 shekels of silver. Well, that doesn't mean a lot to us, but as they've dug up records and they've found, because the Egyptians were very methodical about keeping records, they can show that the price of slaves changed from this period of time, from, I guess it would be the 20th century BC to the 14th century BC, the price of slaves changed 10 shekels of silver. But the bottom line here is that time after time, the historical evidence that they have dug up, when it comes to light in many of these situations, including these accounts here of Genesis, they consistently fit with the time period in which they were written. And so we can rely on the historical accuracy of the Bible as the written word of God. But I need to warn you, despite the evidence that we find here from time to time and we bring it to light, these critics are not going to admit this. They're not going to give up anything for free. It doesn't matter what mistakes are made. Doesn't matter what new evidence comes to light. They are not going to admit it, even if it's right in front of them. And a good example of this is Wikipedia. And I think it's an important subject to touch upon because of how influential it is today in our time. I don't know how many of you are use Wikipedia or are aware of Wikipedia, but it really is an amazing tool. There is such an immense library of facts and information that you could not collect in any other source. I mean, if you want to know what who the city council member was in 1965 in Lodi, California, it's going to tell you and during what years he was there. And there is such a tremendous bulk of information on Wikipedia that's really incredible. But at the same time, we need to keep in mind that Wikipedia is very liberal. And when I say very liberal, I mean very liberal. I mean, just about any liberal, God-hating position you can take, it's going to be predominantly shown in many of these articles. And so if anything is in any way controversial, they're going to take the most liberal position known to man. I don't know if the liberals have a whole lot more time on their hands they can contribute, but I have seen this time and time again. I, from time to time, like to contribute on Anglo-Israelism, basically, you know, American Britain and prophecy. And I contribute to it time and from different times. And I'll post something on there, and within 10 minutes later, I don't know if these guys stay up late at night smoking cigarettes and drinking Red Bull, but they're there and they find it and they change it and they edit it before I even get a chance. And another example of this is if you look right now on the internet, on Wikipedia, about the ancient city of Jericho, they're going to cite Kathleen Canyon's dig that was done in the 1948. And as far as they're going to describe, this is the final say on the matter, is that it was written, you know, that the city of Jericho was destroyed much later than the biblical account. And despite the fact that you've got Bar Magazine, you know, Biblical Archaeological Review Magazine, you've got Liberal Time Magazine admitted it, and you've got all these Bible scholars that admit it, if you go on the Wikipedia, they're going to say, they're going to quote Kathleen Canyon's work that was done in the 1940s. And this is going to happen in numerous entries you're going to read. And so the bottom line is that Wikipedia, it's a good source for the who and the what, but when it comes to the where, the when, and the how, if this is a controversial subject, don't expect to get a whole lot of unbiased positions on these. Another area of the Bible that has received a lot of criticism is the book of Daniel. And a quick way, if you're looking through a commentary and you want to try and determine whether this is a liberal commentary or this is a conservative commentary, you're wanting to buy one off the shelf, a quick way to figure that out right off the bat, turn to the book of Daniel in the introduction and see what they say about the book of Daniel. Do they say it was written, you know, hundreds of years later than when it says? Or does it attribute it to, you know, the, 500s BC. And, the reason that so many are attack Daniel and they want to try and, play games with the time frame when it was written is because of the, specific prophecies in the Bible. Because you think about it, with Daniel, there's not a lot of morality written in it specifically. It doesn't attribute to a lot of the laws of God. It's a lot of it is a historical book and it's a prophetic book. But because these prophecies are so detailed and they go into such detail about events that take place between the king of the north, the king of the south, through these rising empires, a lot of it, it's very hard for them to refute the fact that it was inspired by God if it was in fact written when Daniel said it was written. For instance, you know, the image of Nebuchadnezzar, you know, it describes all of these world-ruling empires that take place. And some of these took place right after Daniel wrote the book, like the Greco-Macedonian Empire by Alexander the Great and others. And so it's hard to explain how Daniel knew about this if you don't acknowledge that it was inspired by God. And this is also shown in the prophecy given in Daniel chapter 3, when it shows the four beasts and it describes some of the attributes of these different empires that came up. And it's hard to explain as well. Another big one is the 70 weeks prophecy. And this is a real hard one because a lot of, not just in the Church of God, but a lot of Protestant and other mainstream Christians have looked at the 70 weeks prophecy, and it's accurate. It shows the time of when the decree went forth to allow the people to go back to have the temple rebuilt. And you do the math and you go forward and it comes back to the coming of the Messiah. And so there's a lot of them that have a problem with that prophecy because of how detailed it is and of the specific timing of the coming of Christ. Another big prophecy in the book of Daniel that they have a lot of problems with is the one that refers to Alexander the Great. Let's turn over to Daniel chapter 11 in verse 4. Daniel chapter 11. And verse 4. Let's pick it up in verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Okay? And when he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up. And that's what happened. As soon as Alexander the Great came to the height of his power, he died right afterwards. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided to the four winds of heaven. The Greco-Macedonian Empire was divided up amongst his four generals. Not according to his posterity, his son did not inherit it. He was not the next king in line. He was very young at the time, and so he kind of got pushed off to the side, and the empire got divided up amongst these four generals. But not according to his posterity, nor to his dominion in which he ruled. And the empire shrunk after this took place, and that's what it's referring to. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for these, besides these. And so, with this prophecy describing how Alexander the Great came to power and how his empire was divided up, it's very hard to describe and have an explanation for this if you don't believe in the validity of the Bible. And so what many times they do is they want to say, well, this wasn't written when the Bible says it was written. It was actually written around the 2nd century BC at the time of the Maccabees. And then to explain away the 70 weeks prophecy, many times they say that this prophecy was actually inserted after the fact in the first century AD because they don't have an explanation for these two prophecies. These are the two ones that really bug them. And so that's how they get around it. Well, that was all fine and good, and nobody really fought them on it until the Dead Sea Scrolls came on the scene. And here's a one of the manuscripts that they found. And the Dead Sea Scroll really posed a big problem for a lot of these Bible mentalists. Because, and there's probably a lot of these guys that wish somebody would have just burnt that cave and never went into it. Because not only was the book of Daniel in and amongst all of these other scrolls and documents that they found, it was part of the canon that they had set aside, and it was, they could date it back to the 3rd century, if not 4th century BC. And so a lot of these events that are described by Daniel took place after the fact. And so they don't have an answer for it. And especially the 70 weeks prophecy, it was in there as well. And so they don't have a lot to say on this. And not only that, but the Dead Sea Scrolls also confirm the accuracy of the Bible. One of the big arguments that had gone around for quite a big period of time was that the Old Testament, you know, it was written over a period of, you know, thousands and thousands of years. There's no telling if there's any accuracy to it. These documents, as they, you know, it's kind of like a story. When you pass it on down the road, it changes by the time it gets back to you. And there's no telling if there's any accuracy to the Old Testament. We don't know how they kept the records. It possibly isn't even close to what the original manuscripts had said. Well, here is the Dead Sea Scrolls came out to be almost identical to the Masoretic text we have for our King James Version. I mean, the only differences were a couple of spelling mistakes and some punctuation marks. That's it. Nothing in there had changed any of the meanings of any of the words that were written. And this poses a big problem for a lot of these minimalists because of the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I only have one thing to say, quoted by Nelson, is ha ha, you know. That's all you can really tell them. It's you got to gloat when you can. But for quite a good period of time, this was one of their big selling points. There was no validity to the Old Testament scriptures. I've got a quote here. From Dr. Archer, and he says, thanks to new linguistic evidence, this is from Reason and Revelation of April 1995, it says, thanks to this new linguistic evidence of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Dr. Archer shows the accuracy of the traditional dating of Daniel around 530 BC. And so this was a big problem that was really in their face, and they really don't have a lot to say about it from the findings of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so when you look at many of these prophecies in Daniel, such as the great image of Nebuchadnezzar, the beasts of Daniel 7, the detailed chronologies in chapter 11, the battles between the king of the north and the king of the south, and the things that Antiochus Epiphanes did. It's really amazing when you read these now in light of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You said these were all written ahead of time, and we have proof that these were written ahead of time. There's a lot of detailed events, especially in Daniel chapter 11. If you read some of the histories of the wars of the Ptolemaic Empire, Daniel chapter 11 that fit the historical depictions as well. And it's really interesting to read it in light of that, knowing that we have proof that these prophecies were given before the events took place. And this really has been a huge victory for the Bible of finding the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the bottom line here is that there are some incredibly specific and detailed prophecies in the book of Daniel that aren't just ambiguous symbolism. These are very specific and very exact. And when we compare it to the historical records, we have a very close match that there really is no accident. You know, we can take heart in the fact that there is archaeological proof that can indisputably show that God was the author and he inspired not only Daniel but the rest of the books to be written. And he's the one who declares the beginning from the end. He's the one who raises up kings and brings them down. And he has the power to declare these situations before they took place. And we have proof of it. And we also have proof that the Bible is an accurate source, that the manuscripts haven't been tampered with. They are accurate. We can read them knowing that they haven't been changed over a period of time. And it's not a bunch of oral folklore, and that there are historical proofs that we have found that have backed this up as well. There's a quote here I'd like to read by Hebrew scholar Miller Burroughs, and he's a distinguished scholar, and he headed up a lot of the collection of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he had this to say. It is a matter of wonder that through something like 1,000 years that the text, you know, the biblical text that we have, underwent so little alteration. As I said in my first article in the scroll, here lies the chief importance supporting the fidelity of the Masoretic tradition. And so time and time again, we see that these critics have been proven wrong. But they quite often follow the same patterns time after time. You know, quite often they will, they may collect their data, and they may be able to log their data in a scientific and methodical manner, but when it comes time to draw their conclusions, well, a lot of times all that neutrality goes right out the window. Another big pattern that I described earlier is there's a great deal of peer pressure amongst themselves to try and come up with information and papers that disprove the Bible. And not only that, quite often they will predominantly show their findings and their conclusions as if there's no other arguments. And they will show it predominantly, but they don't bring up all these other arguments that have brought up to the contrary. And so as we're reading books, as we're reading commentaries, and we're confronted with some of this stuff, these are the patterns that we need to be aware of and consider in, and not be worried by some of their clever arguments, because they're not going to admit it, you know. Well, they for a long time said that, you know, the Hittites didn't exist, and they existed. The Assyrians didn't exist, and they found it. And you're not going to find records where they admitted that they were wrong. They just aren't there. You know, it's interesting. For quite some period of time, they believed that, you know, Belteshazzar, the king of Babylon, he was the one when they, or Belshazzar, excuse me, Belshazzar, he was the one who viewed the writing on the wall, and David or Daniel came and interpreted it. Well, for a long time they said, well, there's no record of this king even existing. And here's another example of a flaw that was written in the records of Daniel. Well, you know, it's interesting. It says that Daniel was made the third ruler in the kingdom. And the reason that was made was because Belshazzar wasn't the first ruler. He was the second. And the primary king was the first one. And sure enough, later on they found records that Belshazzar exactly did exist, and he was the second ruler in the empire of Babylon. But they're not going to admit it. You're not going to find these victories for those who take a conservative approach in any of the books. And we shouldn't expect it. But even though the fact the Bible has been proven to be historically accurate time after time, that characters in the Bible are real, and we have historical proof that that's how they lived, and that's how they lived their lives. But we shouldn't expect the critics to admit they're wrong. We shouldn't expect them to be intellectually honest. We shouldn't expect them to admit fault. But we need to be ready when we're confronted by some of these accusations, when we're confronted by some of these clever arguments, not because we necessarily want to win or shut the other person down, but so that we can remain confident and steadfast, knowing that this book that we have, the Bible, is the revelation of God, and it is accurate, and we can pattern our lives after it. We can spend a lifetime trying to learn to become better people based upon these words and live according to the example of Jesus Christ.